Hello, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. I hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2020 podcast series.
Good evening and thank you very much for joining us for this special Sydney Writers Festival event. I say joining us and I mean that loosely, of course. I mean joining us in the disembodied sense that we now think suddenly is unremarkable, even though it's still the weirdest thing ever. Now, my name's Annabelle Crabb. I'm here in the Sydney Writers Festival Centre on Gadigal country, home to the great Eora Nation. Now, in our strange contemporary way, we also have a clear and direct line into Turrbal and Yugara country, otherwise known as Brisbane, where sits our guest of honour tonight, Trent Dalton, clasping his brand new novel in his shivering hands. It's called All Our Shimmering Skies, as you really couldn't fail to be aware of that. My first order of business tonight is to acknowledge the traditional owners of these two far-flung chunks of our continent, and in fact, the traditional owners of any bit of the country from which you may be watching this evening. Now, this event was going to be held, should there not have been a pandemic. It would have been in the City Recital Hall in Sydney. And in one way, it's a great pity that we can't all be together tonight, but on the other hand, it's given a lot of people around this continent an opportunity to be a part of this event. And also, I feel like if people can join us through the shimmering omnipresence of the internet, it's not a bad thing and not entirely inappropriate that the nation's first glimpse of this novel is going to be from the air. Now, I want to say a couple of words about Trent before I drag him into the discussion. Trent has written millions of words over his career, and most of you will have discovered him through his magazine features or perhaps through his remarkable debut novel, Boy Swallows Universe. But the thing that I treasure most and always have in any form about Trent's writing is his capacity to bring grace to pain, to bring defined beauty in the ordinary and the broken. He brings a cheerful nobility to the ancient art of trudging on when you're really up shit creek. And having read this new novel of his and in the knowledge that hordes of Australians are about to, I really feel a kind of Christmas Eve sense of anticipation and excitement because this book really is a treasure and it's about to be unwrapped by Australians. Trent Dalton, welcome, congratulations and thank you for joining us.
You're a flipping national treasure.
Oh,
you
come are on, stop it.
No, that is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard said about me or that book or anything Annabelle Crabb. Let me just start off by saying, on behalf of all these amazing people who are tuning into this, we all know that this is the equivalent of John Lennon interviewing Justin Bieber about Songcraft. So I feel like I just walked into my hero's television show. So, Annabelle,
oh, that was beautiful.
So thank you for doing this. And this is such a joy. And hello, everybody. This is just the best. This is the best night ever. So thanks for being a part of it.
Now, listen, when you wrote this book, which is, you know, essentially it's a magical bushwalk through Australia's most tangled and beautiful places, and it's a journey undertaken by bereaved souls who've been blasted out of their ordinary lives by a disaster, a global disaster beyond their control, and they're on the way to discovering a deeper truth about what really constitutes treasure and what constitutes truth and happiness. I mean, you hadn't actually envisaged when you wrote it that this thing would lob in the middle of a pandemic, had you?
No, Annabelle, not at all. It was remarkable. And the whole theme of that book is finding light in the dark. And that's a powerful theme that I love, you know, just in any storytelling. And the more that this situation that we're all in now went on, the more I felt like, why did the universe kick me up the backside and tell me to write that book, Annabelle. Like, what the hell? And you just described it so beautifully. People managing their pain, and I don't know. I am really excited about right now to kind of give this book and put it out there, and just sort of hopefully take people to a place that's outside of their living room, you know. And even though we can't get to those places, get on a bushwalk like the one you're talking about, you know, maybe we can through words. And I'm so proud of that kid, Molly Hook, who's at the center of that book, for kind of taking me there for reasons that are so deep and so kind of strong, but never in my wildest imagination could I have thought that it could have landed at a time such as this.
An incredibly appropriate time. I mean, my first thought when I finished reading the book was, I just want to airdrop this over Melbourne. Like, it just, it's a great book to be reading right now. And I'm in the kind of remarkably privileged position talking to you tonight that I've read it, but it's only just come out. So I'm jealous of all of these people who have got this experience in front of them. But I wonder if you could, for the purposes of the discussion tonight, just, I mean, give me a bare bones outline of the plot and characters. I mean, keeping in mind that we've only got sort of an hour, so yeah. I mean, it's a rambling. There's plenty of stuff going on in it.
Yeah, there sure is. Yeah, it's the story of this kid, Molly Hook, a 12-year-old girl whose life is so tough in 1942 Darwin, World War II, that she's come to believe she's cursed. And her life is that tough that even and in her wild imagination, and that's all this kid has, her best friend is a shovel that she uses to dig graves at the graveyard that she's being raised in. And she's come to believe that even the bombs that are dropping across Darwin might even be her fault. And as the bombs fall, she decides, look, I've got to get out of here and I'm going to go deep into that extraordinarily magical Northern Territory wilderness to find the man that she is convinced will be able to remove this curse that she believes has been put upon a family. Now, along the way, she's aided by, you know, kind of my heroes of the story, Greta Mays, this cantankerous, hard-drinking, hard-smoking theatre actress, and a fallen Japanese fighter pilot named Yukio. And these three unlikely companions go on the adventure of a lifetime. And it's a story about gifts that fall from the sky, the curses we dig from the earth and the secrets we bury inside ourselves, Annabelle. And it's my kind of love letter to this kind of wild continent that we all live on. And I just wanted to sort of put, it's my tribute to storytelling, to be honest. Like, it's really just, it comes from every storytelling point of DNA that I have in my body, you know, and it's like 8-year-old Trent Dalton could have written it just as much as 38-year-old, and it took Boy Swallow's Universe to make it happen, to be right. honest.
One book led to the other, you think? Obviously it did in a chronological sense, but you feel like you couldn't have written this book without writing the first one
this,
first.
This was the book I wanted to write, Annabelle. The one, and I wanted to write this kind of story because these are the stories that I love more than anything. It was just the fact that there were these extraordinary people outside my bedroom when I was a kid. You know, all writing is about character, and I just had the most extraordinary characters outside my bedroom that I had to kind of tell the world. Tell the world about, and that being, you know, literally like my mum, my old man, and my three older brothers, right? So it's like, and I just had to get that Boy Swallow's Universe story out of me, and then the doing of that unlocked this kind of treasure chest of stories. And
so it's like one of those giant plugs that are in, you know, canals or something.
Oh, for sure. And I feel like I'm falling down the plug hole now, you know, and this book just now I'm just swimming in that stuff. And it's sort of like, it's really wild. Like, it's really, that's why I talk about the universe, not to get too deep so early, but it's like, it's really big. And that's why I just went with the themes of this story and gifts that fall from the sky and chasing happenstance and finding your own story that you have to tell. And that's what Molly Hook's doing, you know? So it's sort of like, we all have to find our own story.
So one of the things that when we opened up this session to questions, there were plenty of questions, and it's really interesting to see what people ask when they haven't read this book yet, right? I'm going to scatter them throughout our conversation because they'll play nicely with my, of course, brilliantly well-informed questions from having read the book. But a really common thing that came up was you set your first novel, and as you just said, you know, in the architecture and the suburban landscape of your own childhood. It's an amazing jump to take, to move from that into the rainforest around the Northern Territory, these wild landscapes, which almost play the role of a character in this novel. Yeah. So you've expunged these characters from your childhood and made up your own, but you've placed them in a completely different landscape and environment as well. And was that difficult? Was it liberating?
I mean, tell me the psychology of that. What am I doing that? You know, why?
We've only got an hour, Trent.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I ask myself. Why was I needing to run away from Brisbane, you know, and I was running, and I was like running pretty hard from the world of Boyce Willis universe. And the funny thing about that is that doing this book has kind of made me, I want to actually go back to Boyce Willis universe now. And there's things I want to write in that space again. But then I came to a point.
I'm going to stop you right there for a second. Do you think when you finished your first book and had this kind of extraordinary wave of attention, did it change the way you thought about that part of your life? Or was it like, was it an overexposure, or you felt like you needed to move on and tell a different story?
Oh, well, that book just created these amazing. So I think I was carrying around rocks of my own, like Molly Hook in All Our Shimmering Skies. You know, she's got this duffel bag. She carries around this kind of heart-shaped rock, and it's kind of this very symbolic thing in her life. I think I had rocks of my own, to be honest, Annabelle, and it was kind of, I was carrying them around for about 40 years. You know, I wrote Boyce Willis Universe at 38, and it was kind of, you know, it took 38 years plus 1 year to write, you know, and it's like, and I had to just get rid of those rocks that I was carrying around. And then it was the 2 years, like talking about that book and talking about where it came from was really an interesting time. And it's not until people read it and then you get a letter from a 14-year-old kid in Korea saying, hey, thank you for reminding me that that there's hope in the mad situation that I live in right now in my life. And then a girl in Russia or a girl in Texas saying, thank you for reminding me about the light at the end of the tunnel and that it gets good, which is the great secret of Boyce Willis universe, is that no matter what situation you're in, it gets good. And that the stuff that you thought would be your destruction will actually be your creation and the making of you and all of those really powerful things. And so I thought, all right, I'm kind of done with that. And I feel really good about this, because that was a massively, like, pre-COVID days. I was hugging people at signing things, Annabelle, like ridiculous, like just going up, and we'd have like 15-minute chats with total strangers and just go, thank you. And they're sharing and I was sharing. And by the end, you feel light, you know, you feel light and your brain just opens up. And so then I'm starting to go, look, all right, if I'm going to write something again, you know, let's go that way. But then I stopped, you know, and I went, hang on, what am I here for? And just because I realized, like, just because I do write that book and plug all that stuff into Boyce Willis universe doesn't mean it's not still in the back of my mind. Some of those, maybe call them what you want. Some of the tougher aspects of my life from 0 to 20, which is, you know, people going to prison and losing people and addiction and all sorts of dark stuff and violence and all that sort of really kind of heavy stuff. But then I go, well, what am I actually sort of on this planet for? Maybe I am on this planet to write to that 14-year-old kid in Korea and kind of help him get to 20 with another book, you know? And so whilst I place it all in Darwin and World War II, it's just one big veiled Trent Dalton still working on his crap, you know? And so it's sort of, you know, it's like, and I can't help it. And it's like, I think I started to realize, like, no, hang on, man, that's what you're here for. You know, we are here to go deep, you know? And I think, what sort of writer isn't just going deep inside their soul? And it's like, man, I'm not being truthful if I'm not doing that. So I'm still going to do it, and I'll just do it in a different way. And, you know, and this beautiful girl, Molly Hook, helped me do it again, you know? And so it's sort of, it is so different, and it's so wild, and it's such a great place for me to wander through that deep country, Northern Territory. But yet emotionally, it was just right back to the place I know. And hence why the characters are pretty dark. The villains are dark.
Those villains are dark. Yeah.
You know, and those bottles of liquor. And, you know, man, I'm just doing that because they're the kitchens I know. You know what I mean? Like, write what you know. And whilst I don't know what 1942 was like, I know what that kitchen would have been like, you know? And so it's like, all right, I can do that. And I know what it feels like to walk through Northern Territory wilderness, so I can do that. And I know what true love is, so I can chase that, you know? So it's sort of...
How do you know what it's like to walk through the Northern Territory wilderness? Is that just something that's in your brain automatically, or did you go and do that in order to this novel?
The first place I ever flew to, like literally, like I hopped on a plane when I was only 21. I was 21 and I just landed my first job at a little rag called Brisbane News, this free glossy colour weekly, and they sent me to Darwin to do a story. And, you know, I'm on the plane and I hop out of that plane and I'm hit in all five senses by that extraordinary city. And I'm hit by a place that I believe truly was a frontier city that in the 1940s definitely felt like a frontier town. It felt like the Wild West, you know, situated on the northern tip of an already wild continent. But, you know, the heat gets you in that place, the colours get you, the smells, you know, and then when I say the five senses, there's an extra one, and it's the one I care about as a writer, and it's that sixth kind of soul one. It's that one that gets you thinking deep, and it's the type of place where you start looking at the sky and you start thinking deeply. And I went back, it was on that trip, I went to this place called Litchfield National Park, and Litchfield National Park is like about an hour and a half sort of south of Darwin, and I truly believe it's Australia's best kept secret, and it's as wild a landscape as you could ever walk. And I found myself walking across rocky tabletops that feel like Hitchcockian climax locations, and waterfalls that look like strange, you know, that sort of veil strange sort of caves, and genuinely a lost city of stone structures that look like, you know, the bad men in my life frozen in stone. To my wild imagination, this is. And I just kept going back. I've been back to Litchfield National Park three times in my kind of adult life. But weirdly, and just after Boy Swallows Universe, I got sent on a bunch of jobs, right, with the Weekend Oz Mag. And I went to the Flinders Ranges for a job. I went to Uluru to sleep under the stars. And then I went to this place called Groot Island, which is on the edge of Arnhem Land up there. And up there in the Northern Territory, and you know, I'm sitting with this incredible man called Steve Buckala Warramurra, and this guy, he suffers MJD, Mikado Joseph disease, which is sort of quite prevalent on that island. It's a neurodegenerative disease that is kind of inherited, and it's kind of this terrible thing that leaves your muscles kind of failing, but your brain's kind of intact, so you can sort of sense the tragic kind of situation you're in. And Steve has this, and he turns to me and he starts telling me about the magic knowledge that he has from that land. And these are his words, and I'm not qualified to say these words, but he kind of started explaining this extraordinary kind of stuff that he learned from his grandparents and his parents. And he's using the bush medicines of Groot Island to work with Sydney scientists to fix his own condition. And that really just kind of spoke to me. And that afternoon, I distinctly remember I'm having a beer. I'd wrapped up my notes and I'd done the story, and I'm sort of like at the motel. And you know that feeling, Annabelle, you've done the job and you're sort of finished and you're just reflecting. I was by myself, and the whole storm of Boy Swallows Universe was still kicking on. And I remember distinctly, like I get emotional thinking about it. I stared up at the sky and I said a couple of words just in my head to my late father, right? My dad, who's basically Robert Bell in Boy Swallows Universe, like a full, like one of the strongest characters in that book. I resurrected my father for that book. And I'm there at that strange place and I'm looking up at the sky and I just said, you know, hey dad, you know, dad, can you see this? Can you believe this stuff? Like, are you seeing this crazy thing? Like, I feel like it's a dream, dad. And I just remember thinking like, man, I hope you can see it, because he was the biggest book reader, Annabelle. Like, he just read like nobody's business. Literally, the guy in the book in Boy Swallows Universe wakes up and rolls his drum cigarettes, and dad would. He slept on this high jump mattress that he got doing community service at our local school, and oh, not mine, but thankfully, someone else's, a local school in our area. And he'd wake up, smoke his cigarettes, read books, and just to think that his son would have a book up on a bookshelf near his heroes and all that was really profound to me. And then I got thinking on that day profoundly about, well, what are all those private little conversations all of us are having with the sky? And I thought, wow, that's a powerful thought. And you know, the sky gets all our best thoughts and our deepest thoughts, and it's a beautiful transaction that we have. And you know, you know, people don't say anything trivial to the sky. They say things like, "Please help me," and "I love you," and "Thank you." You know, really deep, sort of cool stuff. And I thought, okay, all right. Well, what if this girl on this quest, and you know, she's got the sky to guide her, but also what if the sky's treacherous at the same time? It's light during the day and it's dark at nighttime, and the dark sky tells that girl the truth of her situation. And that all sort of came in together.
Which is shocking, because you know, those of us who have our darkest thoughts at night find a deep and terrifying confirmation in this novel.
Well, that's exactly right, right? You know, the night sky, the night sky tells no lies, you know, and it's sort of, yeah. And you know, I love that great thing that happens at, you know, about 6 a.m. every day, this great illusion happens, which that beautiful blue sky above Australia comes across, and it kind of, and it fools us into thinking there is not eternal darkness beyond it, you know, and you know, that could be seen as, you know, there's a deeper layer to Australia as well. You know what I mean? We're such a beautiful country and we've got so many beautiful things and we're blessed with so much, but we're cursed with a few things as well. And I'm really sort of interested in those sort of the balance of those two things.
Time seems to stretch at different kind of capacities over the course of the book, but easily the longest and most significant is the role of the land in shaping the fortunes of all those who wander across it.
Oh, Annabelle, that's so well said. I mean, you know, I'm really taken with the idea that the earth is our friend and the earth rebels as well. And that's 20 years of kind of the journalism side of things, of going out to these places. You know the places you get sent to. You get sent to the most extraordinary places in our kind of day job as journos, and it's so such a privileged position because you butt up against wonder on such a frequent, on such regularity, and it's so powerful, and you try and channel that into words, and I never could get it inside a 4,000 word magazine piece, you know, and it's like I needed 120,000 words. And what Molly Hook is doing is the same thing. So of course, like any of that stuff, when we talk about country and talking about some of the characters in that book, like Longcoat Bob, this man that Molly's so desperate to find, and he's a man built, he's an Indigenous man, an elder built by rumor, you know, and she has these fantasies of this guy in her head without any fact. And that is also just something I've come across too as a journalist, you know, chasing stories that in reality get proven to be a lot flatter than you think, or a lot, you know, the subject will tell you, hang on, mate, yeah, okay, you're getting a bit ahead of yourself, so pull back. And I love that Molly Hook does the same thing that I do when I am writing any journalistic piece about Indigenous Australia, is I go to it with complete respect, but also first and foremost with wonder and awe of 60,000 years of culture. And that's, I love the fact that that's what Molly Hook's doing. She can't understand it, just like I am not qualified to understand it. I'm a dumb suburban white guy from Brisbane, but what I do know and what I can really infuse Molly with is the wonder of it and coming in the awe of it and kind of and the asking questions. And I love that Molly just goes in there asking questions to try and find the truth of some of these rumors that she's hearing around town, and then also often have the stories kind of the stereotypes are subverted, and there's sort of this wonderful, like, at each point it's like, oh, hang on, it didn't actually quite happen that way. And I found all that really, really interesting and quite deep to me. And as a country, concepts like greed, to implant some of those really big topics like greed inside a story like this, which is just a girl going from point A to point B essentially, but along the way maybe you can touch on hate and love and greed and good and bad, and, you know, really big themes. And I love that you can use a Homer-like story to speak about much deeper matters.
So Molly, your protagonist, I mean, she, in a brilliantly literal term, given your remarks about baggage, she's weighed down with this knapsack, and it's got the stone heart of her mother in it. It's got a pan from her grandfather that she's kind of scrubbing the grime off to read his instructions that he's carved in riddle form. She's got, you know, a bunch of tins of corned beef and, you know, all sorts in there. And of course, her best friend, who's the shovel. So
I love it when you describe things, Annabelle. It's so cool. Yeah.
There's this through line that emerges in the novel: carry all that you own and own all that you carry.
Oh.
Now, it's something that you examine quite tenderly over the course of the book. And I wonder if there's any chance that you would read a tiny little bit for me out of the book. It's on page 228. Your character, Tom Berry, who's the grandfather of the protagonist, Molly Berry, he's the cursed man who, I mean, I think we're not giving too much away to say that he came across a great haul of gold and then bad stuff happened. So could you give us a little bit of a blast of Tom Berry reflecting on some of these themes in the pub?
I'm so glad you chose that passage, Annabelle, because the whole thing about, like, me as a man and a father, I'm constantly questioning the things that are in my blood and the things, and, you know, I'm really interested in this concept of things that get passed down to us, the good things and the tough things. And sometimes we could look at those things as the blessings in our life, and you know, another way looking at the tough ones are the curses in our life, and we're all trying to deal with the things we've been given, and Tom Berry is a character who's trying to reconcile all through the book the things he's done, and those things he's done he will pass down through generations. But here's Tom. "And you wouldn't believe what he said then," Tom Berry whispered to his enraptured audience. "He said he and his family saw no value whatsoever in all that gold. He said real treasure was a freshwater spring." He's talking about Longcoat Bob and Longcoat Bob's view on gold. "He said the real jewels of earth were gooseberries that grow on trees. He said a good dig in his world is when you stick your fist down a bubble in the mud and find a long-necked turtle to grab hold of. He said true wealth isn't having your pockets filled with coin, but your belly filled with white turtle flesh cooked in its juices, shell down on a bed of coals. He said the only use for gold was to glitter. And he said the glitter of gold was like the glittering smiles of us white men he'd seen in town dressed in expensive clothes. He said that gold can't be trusted. He said we all got the gold disease and it rots our hearts. It poisons us. He said it changes who we are, how we behave." And that's just a little passage of Tom, but it's so deep, all that stuff, and it's about, all through the book, the characters are talking about what should we do with this earth, and gold miners and miners just across the world, and the history of mining is filled with myths and conversations about be careful how deep you dig, you know, to the point where, like, don't dig too deep, you might wake up the devil, or don't dig too deep because the earth will dig something out of you in return. And all of that deep stuff I love as a storyteller. That's really deep moral stuff that we're dealing with.
So is this just like part of the torture that a writer puts a character through? I mean, I can't help but draw a little parallel between Molly and Eli, your protagonist from the first book, who shares this sort of sunny optimism and this sort of steely capacity to crash through and pursue joy, even when everything around them is just so dreadful and leaden and discouraging. And, you know, I mean, there's almost this kind of cloud of, you know, dramatic irony that hovers around these kids. Like, I mean, as a reader, in both of their cases, they keep plugging on and I'm kind of yelling, give up, you know. It's like watching a horror movie when you're kind of watching the kid go down to, you know, explore the terrible noise in the basement. You're like, don't do it. So, I mean, there's an extent to which these characters are kind of naive and sort of a bit left out of the joke, you know, the adult joke. And I'm wondering, like, is this a sort of youngest child situation, Trent?
Oh, man. Annabelle, you know what? You have to have a huge heart to ask a question like that. So thank you for, like, because you're getting me emotional thinking about it as you're talking, because when you were asking that, I'm thinking about the Dalton boys in, like, 1992, you know, and I am the youngest boy in that amazing army of brothers, and you know, I've got three older brothers, Joel, Ben, Jesse, then Trent. And I've never said this in anything, even talking about Boyce Falls Universe, but it's your beautiful question that has prompted it. And the version of myself I was always the most proud of, and the version of my brothers was the one during the darkest moments, and literally often the best times. Nobody saw how great the Dalton boys shone when we were walking down to a phone box trying to contact someone, and we've left a scene of blood and violence and kind of crazy kind of suburban madness, you know. And it's those times you just love those people so much. And I have such love for those boys, and And I have such love for that version of myself at that age, you know, and there's no doubt that I'm just, that's kind of me there in Molly. I mean, I've got to be honest, like, I mean, I'm just, you know, yet again, kind of just putting that kid there, but I know the value that can come from overcoming those obstacles. So I have thrown so many at that poor girl. And it's even worse in this case because that girl is such an amalgam of my two beautiful daughters who never thankfully have to see anything like that, the stuff that Molly sees. But that girl is a product of my youngest daughter, this beautiful girl that I just worship, you know. I think she's just the coolest kid. She comes to me and she says, "Dad," you know, she's had this grandparents' day where my mum has visited the school, and maybe some of the teachers and some of the parents know the story of her because I kind of went and wrote a bit about it in Boy Swallows Universe. And I've told Sylvia the whole thing and the whole story of that, but still it's sort of complex for her, you know. And she comes back that afternoon and she's like, "Dad, you wrote that book, Boy Swallows Universe, about these two beautiful boys, but you're a dad, you're a father of two girls." And it's like, why wouldn't you write a book about two girls? And it's like, yeah, why the hell wouldn't I, you know? And so it's even more complex because there's so much of my daughters in that kid, Molly Hook, you know? And so when I'm doing these horrendous things to her narratively, it hurts, you know? But I'm so proud of her, you know, just the same way I'm proud of us boys back in the 80s and the 90s to sort of kind of swim through some of that stuff and keep our heads up out of water and not succumb to it. So it's sort of really deep, like it's sort of me going, "Come on, man, come on, Molly, you can do it." And if I can put that, if I can just invest get a bit of that in these fingertips, get it into the keyboard and onto that page, some of the feeling I'm just drawing on and just I have to, truth is, Annabelle, I have to write from this place of just emotion. I think I've really realized, and I've always, like, I've written journalism pieces. Do you remember once you sent me the kindest email in about 2012? I remember it vividly. You probably don't because you'd probably do this all the time. But out of the blue, can you imagine a chump journo getting a flippin' email from Annabelle Crabb? And I've written a story about a cook, a chef who makes a mud cake, a fruit cake, that's inspired by true love and the loss of his wife. And the whole thing about that story was a riddle to get to the last sentence in which you're trying to find the secret ingredient of Jeff Beattie's beautiful dark chocolate fruitcake. And you sent me that beautiful thing and it's so deeply inspiring. And so you're just encouraging these people, come on, you know, you can do it. And it's the power of encouragement and all of that. I throw all of that. And it's sort of, you know, that's what I learned in journalism too, just write with emotion. And that's what I started crying when I wrote that Jeff Beattie piece. And you responded to that, you know, and that helps. And so then it goes, okay, we'll keep doing
but
that.
But it wasn't, I mean, like the email wasn't about the cake, although I'm very drawn to cake, as you know. But like the thing that really just moved me about that piece that you wrote about that man was that you took the time, you know, like you walked, it's a story that people would walk past, you know, like one man and his grief and his like weird obsession with cake or whatever, but you stopped and you talked to him deeply and you paid attention and you kind of picked up all of these little pieces of his life and you kept them as though they were honourable things, which they are. And I think that this sort of ability that you have to find things and to make them precious is actually quite an extraordinary observational power as much as it is a storytelling power. And to watch you do it over the course of a book is quite an amazing thing, and for a reader, hugely impressive and very moving. I wonder, when we opened up to questions, pretty understandably, I guess, one of the really constant themes from people writing in was, God, how did you attempt a book like this in the wake of Boy Swallows Universe? And I'm going to read you a couple of, just because I feel like I've not really let other people ask questions enough here and I've been hogging you. Samuel Elliott asked, how have you overcome the pressure of writing a follow-up to such a hugely popular debut novel? Charlene Morn asks, Did you have concerns that the success from Boy Swallows Universe would set unrealistic expectations on All Our Shimmering Skies or be compared in a negative way? And what did you tell yourself to overcome these concerns? I'm feeling anxious even reading these questions. Carol Horton says, given the success of your first novel, did that make it harder to write? I mean, I'm interested in your answer to this because it doesn't really feel a lot to me like the pressure to come up with the product is really the kind of the real gas in your machine.
Yeah, you know, it's the journo thing's very helpful with that. You know, just meet the deadline, right? Just you know, hope your story doesn't get spiked. Keep on writing. Write the next one. You know, the funny thing about that whole pressure, and thank you for the questions, you beautiful people tuning
in. I'm worried about you, that you're under pressure.
I know, thank you for caring about me. the truth is, I really did push all that aside, and it's so funny that no matter how much you push it aside, you keep getting reminded about it, because people would send me emails and they're just like, now, don't worry about all the pressure. Just tune it out. Tune all the pressure, capital letters. I know there's so much pressure, you know, and it's you're just like, stop, I'm not feeling the pressure, but I am when you make such a, should I be feeling the pressure? And, but the cool thing that I did, and I don't know why I did this, I just pushed it aside and just went, who the hell do you think you are? You know what I mean? Like if I was to feel pressure, then that would mean I have elevated myself to a place that I don't deserve to be, in the sense that, man, I'm just learning. I feel about novel writing, Annabelle, like I felt when I started writing long form features for Q Weekend magazine on the Courier Mail. Like that was my first proper kind of journo job, and I just wanted to write every last story about every Australian who has ever lived and currently living. And I had so much to offer, you know, and I bloody attacked that job so much, and I haven't, to be honest, to be truthful, I haven't felt like that in a while, and I feel it, you know, I feel it with this whole book thing, and I'd have so much to learn, and so I just ran with that, you know. I pretended like it was just my second long-form feature, and I want to impress Christine Midap, editor of the mag, you know, and it's like, she's a really good person to have in your mind, because she's such a tough critic, but that's what I've done for, I mean, million, like so many stories. And so that was really helpful to just go, nah, just file it, get the job done. And then, and then I swept all that aside, and then I said, all right, just go for the fence, you know, swing, try and hit a six out of this thing, and don't hold yourself back, because it's all gravy. You're like, you're so bloody lucky, right? Like, and I swear to God, year six, Brighton State School, out near Brackenridge, growing up, my old man, one of the few parent teacher nights he attended, Mrs. Garside calls him in and says, I didn't, you know, he comes home, and I said, oh, I had the parent teacher night going. He goes, what the bloody hell have you been doing at that school? Because Mrs. Garside said to me, Mr. Dalton, I'm terrified your son is going to become the leader of an outlaw motorcycle gang. And so that's an incredible kind of destiny, and it's a very empowering destiny in a sense, because anything better than that is gold, you know, and it's a cherry on top.
Also, like, I don't want you to take this the wrong way, Trent, but I would not feel that menaced by that bikie gang.
You imagine?
Hey, like, guys. The bikie gang is going to come in and, like, write something really perceptive about my, like, living room.
I'm just going to go talk this guy's ear off. I'm going to intimidate this guy. Yeah. You imagine. But I thought, look, there's no expectation. It doesn't matter. You're the luckiest man alive. And if it goes south immediately, you know, all you need is that wife who's beside you all the time and those two beautiful kids that maybe inspired the bloody book you're writing. So what do you care? However, around this time, I'm shit scared about the whole thing, because you just don't care about it, you know. So suddenly it's getting real, and then you see it in the flesh, and it's like, it's suddenly like, oh man, this is a real thing. And so forget all that. I'm terrified, you know?
What I'm interested in too is, like, your kind of secret source is really being an observer, right? You know, you've been doing that your whole life. You've observed all sorts of things over the course of your life. And the capacity that you have to slip into people's lives and to talk to them and to inspire faith in them and have them unfurl things before you is a huge part of your trade. And in some ways, being a kind of a neutral presence is a part of that, right? Do you ever worry that the more famous you get, the less neutral a presence you are when you're talking to somebody about making jam or grieving this extraordinary loss that's happened to them, or even just, undertaking some mundane life activity that you can bring this insight to?
Yeah, I mean, that stuff is actually really good for the soul. Like, that was really helpful to me to get my head out of the clouds with Boy Swallows Universe and go back to the day job and kind of do the journalism thing, which is something I'll always return to because I do feel it's just good for me. And one of the things I did straight after, like, coming, I took basically 6 months long service leave to write All Our Shimmering Skies. And then the first gig I kind of almost did, I had this idea on the Weekend Ausmag where I said to my editor, Christine, I want to just take a street and I want to walk up and down that street, keep knocking on doors and people until people let me in, asking the same question, which was, hi, my name's Trent Dalton. I write for the Weekend Australian Magazine. I want to write a story where I detail every last secret you have in your life, but I do it in a beautiful way and we learn so much from that. And then I'll go to your neighbor's house and we'll find out whether there's a matrix of interconnected kind of stories. And maybe you can write it like a long form kind of Netflix series, but it's just about six ordinary people living on this street called Sunny Avenue in Brisbane. And, and in the process of that, maybe three people told me to F off and a couple of people thought I was a solar panel salesman. And it's just really good for the soul to have doors slammed in your face in that way, even if you're trying to go there with really honourable sort of reasons and going, yeah, I think it could be something beautiful. Really interesting thing about that was, though, the person who really kick-started that piece was this beautiful woman named Tracy Gregg, opens the door and she's like, oh, I read your book. You're that guy. You're that guy.
Yeah, right.
So immediately you've got this kind of like, Okay, here's the truth of it, Annabelle. Like, I've for a lot of my journalism career, I've lost sleep on the things I've done to people in the nature of that job. So, I mean, actually, like, maybe when I feel in my 20s or just starting out, I was probably too ambitious and just went a bit hell for leather and really gave into my ego and tried to really, I don't know, try and make my way through journalism. And I do believe I kind of did things that I regret. I did things that I regret and that I kind of ruined someone's day when I didn't have to. You know what I mean? And I just...
You went in when you should have knocked on the grass?
You know it, right? Okay, well, I got a letter. I got a phone call once from exactly a moment like that. You know, death knock, should have knocked on the grass. And the father called me and went, you are a scum of... You're just the scum of the earth. Why did you do that? And the time I knocked, the mother was inside with her son's ashes. That freaking changed my life. And I'm getting emotional thinking about it, but it changed my life. Like, it changed the way I see the world. And so a lot of that stuff and a lot of that Boy Swallows Universe, to be honest, was me going, hey, you gave to me so beautifully in that story and that other story. And you over there, you did that for me. Well, here's me. If it ever is going to be me telling my story, hence why I get interviewed now and I just don't shut up. It's like, take the story. And I need to pull back, but I can't because I feel this kind of pact, it's the sacred pact of like, look, so many people have given their stories to me.
You've asked so much of others.
I have asked so much and I want to honor them so much and go, hey, thank you for that. And, well, here's my story. You want some bloody flesh from me? Well, take it, man. Take my heart and soul because I owe it to you, And it's sort of like, and I don't know whether that's healthy, but it's kind of beautiful in a way too because
it's trust honest,
exercise.
It's honest.
Yeah, well,
I should just intervene to say we've just used this term knocking on the grass, which is like so well known to journos.
Yeah, please.
Maybe not.
Please remind. Yeah, have you ever had to do that? Can you explain it by ever having,
knocking on the grass is when you're sent out as a journo, usually with a photographer, to knock on the door of someone who's just lost someone in horrific circumstance or just, the home of a recently bereaved person. And you always get sent out to these things, even the most horrific moments. And sometimes you knock on the grass, which is where you you make a knock that no one can hear so that you can leave them be. And I did that once with a family of two children that had died in the back of a car, you know.
Oh, man.
Trapped in there. And you can't, sent there the next day.
That's cool. Good
Sorry
call.
To my chief of staff. Yeah. I just could not go and pound on their door.
Good call. Good call but, every day of the week, you know. It's the right call.
I do remember instances where I probably should have and I didn't. So, I think we're all haunted by those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's powerful stuff. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that's...
But nobody could accuse you of not... repaying the debt to disclosure.
Thank you.
But, the truth is, you kind of are, you can provide this sort of longitudinal service. I'm not surprised that you hear from all these people all over the world, because you can provide this perspective as a kid who's lived through a lot of stuff and is still kind of struggling towards some sort of resolution and peace,
but
you've made a lot of milestones along the way, and I think that's one of the things that people find draws them in to what you write and the way you write, which is erring towards, what would Molly Hook say, grace, graceful, you've got to be graceful, right? And that's, as she walks through this landscape, she meets crocodiles that she trusts, she meets... Japanese fighter pilots that she trusts.
Oh, my God. Her trust levels are through the roof, aren't they? Oh, my God.
I mean, that's the definition of grace, isn't it? To be able to be trust where you've been disappointed so many times in the past, to kind of, put your poker chips all on the good side of human nature. And I think to overcome injury to yourself and be able to... be positive is such a hard thing to master, probably the greatest lesson of life, I guess, isn't it?
You're giving me chills. You're giving me chills, Annabelle, because you've just defined what's at stake in that book. And it's a battle for Molly's trust in the world, and it's being frayed, like she's just losing it. And hopefully by the end, we know where that is. And, man, you've just defined it. Like, it's so true. I was doing that unconsciously, but she has, I truly believe in enthusiasm, the concept of enthusiasm. And I know you bloody have it in spades because you just do so many flipping things in life and just do it with such passion, And I think that's such a, my girls watch, further back in time for dinner. I'm just going, look at that family you've got there, like the Ferones, I just go, they're phenomenal. I just go, I want girls, look how that woman and her eldest daughter just approached life.
They'll have a go at anything, right?
Have a go. They are up for it. And I just, sorry to go sidetrack, but
you're not sidetracking.
That's that Molly thing. It's like, that's what the Ferones, they're trusting you and they're going, all right, oh, so that's toilet paper from the early 1900s. Right, okay. And that's what was it, that kind of horse head thing, and I'll cook that up and, I mean, unbelievable. But what I'm trying to say is just enthusiasm, and that is trust in the world at the same time. It's an act of faith to be enthusiastic in anything. And that's why people who can't be enthusiastic are cynical. And that's the very opposite of our enthusiasm. And it's the cynics who they're all across social media and they're all across our day jobs and they're everywhere. And we can't let them win, And they're almost going to win against Molly. And I just, I'm just fighting for her all through that book to kind of win, to have her own little wins in trust, and keep trusting Greta, trusting Yukio, And I love those stories where two people looking for something lost. But, so they go looking for something and forget that it's right there in the person they're with. And that's a really cool thing, that's like love and relationships, right? That's marriage and all that stuff, all that cool stuff is we're all searching for bigger things when forgetting, oh shit, man, it's just here. It's like, that's all it was, Yeah.
I can't let you go. We are running out of time, unfortunately, but there's a couple of questions that have come through. Some of them are there's one in particular that's sort of brilliantly random, and it makes me think that it's someone from your past.
Oh, no. Who is it? One of my brothers, probably. Oh, no. Oh, this is terrible.
It's somebody called Alan Kelly.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. No, no, okay. But I know anyway, many Kellys. I know many
right,
Kellys.
Right, okay. Okay, Alan Kelly writes, this is just so random. There's actually some other stuff that I want to hear the answer to. This one is just so
this is
crazy
great.
That
this day. Is great.
Is there a chapter in All Our Shimmering Skies that begins with a line remotely resembling, quote, "Our Christmas tree is an indoor plant named Henry Bath," close quote.
That's so funny, so funny. The Dalton boys had a... Our Christmas tree was the lamest Christmas tree in Brackenridge, Annabelle. And my old man named it things from literature. And Christmas Day, like it's such a pull out the violin, but it's like, you know, you'd wake up on Christmas Day in our house and it was so fun, like so sweet. You know, our old man really tried. He freaking loved you so much, Dad. You know, if I'm sorry to talk out of school, but, you know, he'd wrap these gifts up in the courier mail and, you know, and it'd be just like a... It'd be like a we, none of us had cars, but we'd get like a grip mat for a dashboard for a Christmas present, and it would be
or a
under,
jumbo car sponge. Like
you know, I was about to say sponge. That's exactly what you'd get. That type of style. Happy birthday, Merry Christmas, and it would be all sitting under this limp tree that wasn't like a spine. You know, like what was a pine tree or something, but it was this limp. Hanging tree that Dad put his cigarette butts out on, and he would name it things from literature, and yeah, so it had the name Fangorn from Tolkien, like for Fangorn Forest, but it was not a forest at all, and that Henry Bath thing is this mix of me sort of riffing on that in literature, sort of saying yeah, let's name it after all
that's so good.
Literary influences. So.
At least it wasn't called like Robert Plant or something. I mean,
oh my God, that is a great name for a plant. Come on,
yours with my compliments.
I've got one of my best friends is a massive Zepp head. I've got to go, man. You got to get yourself a plant and call it Robert.
I think that may have been thought of. All right. Claire Williams, I'm also going to just pop her question through to you because
on your Claire.
I wonder if she was your neighbour. Do you see any future novels or stories where other untapped characters from your life in Brisbane's Bracken Ridge could be explored, says Claire, who used to live next door to you? She didn't, I don't think, but yeah. Or would you prefer to move away from writing more on characters from your childhood? To be honest, I think we kind of covered that already. I just wanted to check if Claire Williams was your ex-girlfriend or something.
Claire. There's many Claires in my life.
Forgotten ex-girlfriend.
Yeah. Oh, the funny thing about that is you write a book like that and when the minute people hear that,
oh, am
like,
I in it,
yeah that happens a bit, and it's like I'm her aren't I, and it's like thanks for writing that character about me, and sometimes you know what, I just went yeah, no worries, it is, you know,
so your approach to that is just a sort of quizzical smile,
yeah silent, like you know we'll just keep that between us. Yeah.
All right, just don't ever have a, you know, a party where they're all invited or things will get massively awkward.
Yes.
Look, Chloe has asked a question that I'd selfishly like to hear the answer to as well. She says, you've said that you read a lot of long-form journalism, but who are your literary, i.e. novelistic, influences? Chloe says, I thought of Tim Winton when I read Boy Swallows Universe, but I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Oh, thank you so much, Chloe, for that great question. It's really cool. Winton, definitely. Like, Cloud Street was kind of really kind of brilliantly kind of inspirational in the sense that, oh, man, that's, yeah, right, that's just a street. That could be Bracken Ridge that he's writing about. And those families and you know, that wonderful... In the same way, Ruth Park is a massive influence in my life. And Ruth, I remember reading Poor Man's Orange, and even though that has nothing to do with Brackenridge in the early 1990s, I just went, oh, my God, that father is my dad. And those characters, that woman, that's my mom. And you know, I'm amazed with those brilliant Australian writers who... And tapping into... I'll tell you about this one. One... amazing Australian writer, Geraldine Brooks, who I just have this massive, you know, highly respectful crush on. And she wrote this line when she was talking about this amazing book, Year of Wonders, and it was my dad passed that book to me. And I remember reading that just going, oh, my God, that, you know, this woman, a widow in a plague village, expecting to die but finding so much life. And Geraldine spoke about the writing of that book, and she he said this beautiful quote that I really returned to in the writing of All Our Shimmering Skies, which was, don't be afraid to see dead people. And she walked through to get the sort of whole inspiration for that amazing book. She walked through these old European graveyards and found and brought characters to life from epitaphs. And, you know, there's a bit of that in All Our Shimmering Skies. Molly Hook sort of does a similar thing. She's become friends with these epitaphs, you know, that are in her graveyard that she's grown up in, you know. But broadly, you know, Steinbeck's a massive one. The last couple of pages of The Grapes of Wrath changed my life, like just at the exact moment when I needed to read them. Rosa Shan Joad.
That's a hell of a reveal.
The reveal, right? I mean, yeah. And just reminds us, no matter what, you know, what a
how
better moment.
Things are. Yeah.
Right, like right now, everyone just read the last two pages of Grapes of Wrath. I mean, the world we're in right now, and you remember the great lesson of no matter what comes, always be kind. It's just, man, what a lesson. And he's a guy like Hemingway that I admire because they're guys who are so in touch with the darkness and the fact they've seen so many dark nights just only enhances their ability to write about the sun rising, you know, and the sun also rises and all that. But it's like so true, you know, those guys in touch with their own darkness that could write about the light so powerfully. And yeah, so those people all listed are definitely great influences, Chloe.
Oh, it's interesting that you should, and we do have to finish up, but it's amazing that you should refer to, you know, the role of the light and the sun rising and setting and that rhythm of life. Because I think sometimes the way that you write is a bit like light, you know, like sometimes it's playful, sometimes it dances around, and sometimes it's really searching, and sometimes it's merciless. But I think your great strength across all of your forms of writing is always that you are kind, you know, that you give the planet the benefit of the doubt, I guess,
is the thing
you do. So
I just
was thinking about, you know, this grubby old pan that Molly carries around with herself, part of her baggage, right? Like it's kind of got something written on it, but she's having to scrape off all the muck and all of this sort of accumulated pain and horror from her life. And, you know, eventually it shows it the way, but there's a lot of scraping involved. And I think that's, you know, it's a very good analogy for what you've done in this book and the way that you write more broadly. So from all of our lucky people who are holding this book in their hands and waiting to open it up, I can assure them that it's like massively worth it, and also just wanted to thank you for writing it and so quickly as well, which is bloody a good thing in a second book.
You had a massive hand in that book, you know, because you're just bloody inspirational. And honestly,
now that's a lie.
No,
I mean, nothing is the truth.
Like, you got to know, I consider you like at the peak of Kurt Cobain's career, where he got all the unknown bands from Seattle and he helped them out. You know what I mean? He helped them all out. And I feel like you do that so often for Australian writers, Annabelle. And I just think it's an utterly generous thing to do. And you've done it again tonight. And I know everyone here who's tuning in has come to see you, and you know, my wife has, and my kids have, and I just think you just rock, and thank you so much. It's hugely humbling to have a chat with you about this book.
Well, a typically serious, typically generous series of untruths. Thank you, Trent. Thank you, well done. And I'd like to thank all of you too for tuning in to this Sydney Writers Festival special event. I know it's been hugely long awaited and worth the wait, I think. I'd also like to thank the event's chief sponsor tonight, the Feds Festival's principal partner, ARA, and particularly Ed Federman for his continued support of the festival in this completely ridiculous year. We need all the support we can get at the Sydney Writers Festival, and it's great to be able to come together for events like this one. Stay tuned, there'll be more. Thanks and good night.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.